I was the first woman working on that as the only animator, and they gave me the Fairy Princess to animate, and I did such a good job that the Disney animator, Freddie Helmick, he said to my friend, he says, I think we have a new girl animator. And that was actually a compliment, not me being the girl. It meant an animator in Disney, they used to call them girl animators because they could draw girls really well.
To the Ink and Paint Girls podcast, where we celebrate women working in animation, illustration, and comics. In an effort to share their stories, we not only cover the steps they have taken to get to their dream jobs, but also the struggles. We highlight artists, writers, and producers, explore the ups and downs of working in the industry, and discuss female representation behind the scenes and on the screen. From character animator to character designer to timer to directing commercials, Benita Versch has worked in the animation industry for over 30 years. You'll recognize some of these titles: The Rugrats, Rocko's Modern Life, Scooby-Doo, and so many others. But I personally would love to highlight The Jetsons. How cool! Veteran animator and previous Ink and Paint Girls podcast guest, Linda Miller, also is on the show. She's helping me co-host. Bonita, Linda, and I discuss the heyday of Klasky Csupo, how it was easier for her to be a director for commercials rather than animated television, and how she made it through the decline of hand-drawn in-house animation.
Well, I always liked to draw ever since I was a kid. And I came from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and went to the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and they had a fine art department, and I actually majored in life drawing. So we had, you know, what are you going to do with life drawing? What kind of job are you going to get? Well, when I was a senior in college, I don't know why, but the thought came to me, animation. I was actually working in a watercolor class, and I was making these really interesting watercolors, and I thought, I wish I could make this move. I wanted to make an animated film. It just came to my head. I went to our library. There were two books, one about the history, a little bit, and one about Disney, and it had Hanna-Barbera and Disney. So I wrote to both of them because I knew when I graduated, I was going to come to California with my boyfriend. And sure enough, I got two letters back. I wrote to both of them. I said, I got my portfolio, blah, blah, blah. And Hanna-Barbera wrote back and said, sure, come on in. We'll look at your portfolio. Disney wrote back. This was 1968. No, we're not looking at portfolios at this time. And that was sort of a down period, right, from Disney?
Yeah, it wasn't really until about 10 years later that they started looking for new blood, as it were.
New blood, which eventually led to kind of a reinvention of Disney, when they actually started hiring people to train again.
Yeah.
And that was in, what, the late 80s, early 90s, right?
Yeah, that was after, well, actually that was after everybody left to form Bluth Studios, because they had to find like 20 new people.
Well, that's another, but that, yes, because what happened with my story is I came to California and I did get a job in the ink and paint department, my very first job. Mm-hmm. It was, you see, I didn't know that in Hanna-Barbera it was a production studio. They were the masters of limited animation that all the animators really hated because it was so limited. But you had to be a very good animator to make it look, you know, when you're just moving all these levels of head, you know, back and forth, the lips moving. And you only had 6 levels. Remember? 6 levels.
I didn't learn to work that way. It's entirely different from the process in feature animation. It's a lot more like animating in Flash, where you have all the elements separated.
Well, I learned that's the basic, you know, animation 101. You have 6 levels, otherwise the cells begin to get too gray. And what was so interesting about working at Hanna-Barbera is that everything was in one building. And one of my first jobs was what you would call, besides after the ink and paint, on gold. And then I got a job as a cell wiper because the summer job ended and cell wiping maybe lasted another month or so. And then I got laid off, and then I got called back to be like a PA in the layout department, which was incredible. All the great artists that were at Hanna-Barbera, Ewald Takamoto, Willie Ito, Jerry Eisenberg, Homer Jonas, Takashi, a whole bunch of really interesting people were working in the layout department. And I was like 21, 22 years old with a little blonde afro and little mini skirts, and I had bells on my shoes, and I would come in, you know, and it's Benita, and all the boys were
the hippie chick.
Yeah, I was like the mascot.
It's interesting also, all those Asian guys, you know, that was very different from, you know, the very white scene at Disney.
Well, Willie Ito, he actually was a Disney animator way back when. He started at Disney. And then they all got laid off during that, when everything went kind of under. And then in the 60s and late 50s, that's when Hanna-Barbera, you know, they had all the hits, Yogi Bear, Flintstones, and everybody loved the Jetsons the best. And I came into Hanna-Barbera when they were doing the Wacky Races, Scooby-Doo, and all these of them. They had just sold Hanna-Barbera to, what was it, Viacom? Trent Silverman was the new boss. But Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera still ran the studio. And, you know, it was such a great experience because Mel Blanc and June Ferre and people were coming all the time because they did voiceovers and stuff. They had a recording studio right in the factory, you know, and right near the layout department.
And the interesting thing about that building, it was a maze. I used to tell people that somewhere in the middle of the building was a big piece of cheese because that was the only explanation I had for it. You know, it was almost impossible to find your way across the building.
And what's very interesting, they had by that time developed a system of called same as animation, where they would have a Xerox copy with they would have a scene with all the cells and everything, they're both stacked away. So say you had Scooby-Doo and he's running. Run cycle number 485, you will pull it out, it will be on your storyboard, and if you're animating it, you will put it out, and you would retime it, calling for the same drawings and the same cells. And it was a huge department. And so part of my job as a PA, you would call it, was to, you know, gather layouts and make scenes and take them to the different department. So I was quite the mascot of the studio. Everybody sort of knew me. And when I had downtime, I actually did some woman animator, and I don't know her name. She was probably the only one there. She taught me to do assistant animation when I had nothing else to do. I was actually sitting in the Ewald's room drawing and cleaning up layouts and all kinds of stuff. So that's how I learned, literally, by sitting at the feet of some of the best, at that time, commercial, you know, artists, animation artists, because Hanna-Barbera, whatever you want to call it, they were in the heyday. They were the heyday. They kept animation. They revolutionized animation. Yeah. Saturday morning cartoons.
It was interesting, too.
And they did it all in-house.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. When Bluth made the Dragon's Lair games, we used a stock system,
mm-hmm.
very much like Hanna-Barbera, because Don Bluth had worked for several years at Filmation, so he had that knowledge of how to store scenes and pieces of action that would be useful, and that is the way we were able to make the video games happen.
Now, another, see, for me, as a, now, I'm a young gal, but I could draw my ass off, okay? I could draw. And the one thing you say about animation, most, even the writers had to know. In the beginning of Hanna-Barbera, the writers had to know how to draw because they drew their pictures and they drew their stories. They didn't just write them down on a script and tag somebody. They actually drew it. And Joe Barbera would work with the writers, and it was all visual gags.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have that kind of creativity anymore.
No, and you can sometimes look at a script and know that somebody doesn't get how animation works. I worked on the 101 Dalmatian series at Disney, which looked nothing like the movie. And I was storyboarding, and the script pages were describing the puppies stealing a car. But the script pages sort of assumed that the puppies were the size of humans and could drive a car, rather than each individual puppy, you know, handling, you know, one of the many things you have to do in order to drive a car.
They didn't even describe a visual gag, which, which if you were a true animator and true storyteller in animation, that's how you work, you know, true, and writers now,
most people who write don't come up from the drawing end of things. It's a whole different career path.
And that's why they use, especially at Disney, they use different talent to fill in the gags and the visual gags. So the storyboard artists, all of a sudden, they take this usually really boring script and make it into a movie, right? And that's the kind of the premise. That
depends on the script.
Yeah.
When I was boarding on Sophia, you know, there was fun stuff to be had, but as a storyboard artist, I always felt that it was kind of my job to make it funny whether it was supposed to be or not.
Mm-hmm. So anyhow, that was in the 60s. Now, I worked, during that time, I met my husband and I had a baby. So in those days, you could take your work home with you. In fact, there was so much work at Hanna-Barbera, they had to outsource it, and they loved it when you worked at home. So in order for me to work at home, I had by that time become a bit proficient in assistant animation, because that's all they would have given me, assistant animation. And so that's what my next job was. I became a very good assistant animator, at first working for Disney, and then Filmation, and then all of a sudden I met Lee Mishkin, who was a very well-known freelance animator that worked in Hollywood. He came from Disney, he worked on the Yellow Submarine. He had his own little studio, and he and another great animator, Freddie Helmick, and then a younger friend of ours, they got a project called The Fairies. And it was like one of the first rock videos. There was a book, a series of books called Fairies and Witches.
Yeah, Brian Froud.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we did a show, a half-hour special. In those days, television, you could get a half-hour special. So I'm freelancing with Hanna-Barbera, and I'm getting to know, when you're a freelancer, you hear, okay, there's a little studio. In Hollywood, there are all these little studios.
Mm-hmm.
Bullwinkle Studio up on Sunset Boulevard, they had the Bullwinkle statue. I went in there. Chuck Jones, I worked with one of his main animators. He was one of my mentors. I can't remember his name. And Lee Mishkin. Now, Lee Mishkin did a lot of commercials. But he was a very good animator. And when you animate the commercials, it's like a Disney style.
Yeah.
But it's more Looney Tunes. You have to be very flexible. So I wanted to animate more Disney-like. I wanted to, Hanna-Barbera is a style. So I wanted to get fuller animation. I tried to get into Disney during that time. They wouldn't even look at my reel because they wanted me to, I was already animating, and they wanted me to start as an assistant in-betweener.
Yeah.
And by that time, I'm a single mom and blah, blah, blah. I needed more money, so forget Disney.
The salary was something like 90 bucks a week.
Yeah, and so in my day, there was no animation schools. In fact, Cal Arts started in, what, the 90s? Or the
60s? No, they had a program in the early 70s. I think they started it in the 60s, actually, because that was the Disney school, but they wouldn't let me in.
Yeah. Mm. So anyhow, but I didn't have that. And that was a very elite. It was a very, you know, by that time I had a career. I was working. So my history is I learned by doing. And I was an assistant animator for 7 years before I became an animator. But I made it my business to work with some of the best freelance animators around, and that's how I learned. Because I was his personal assistant. I worked for Duck Soup. I don't know if you ever heard of Duck Animation.
They're still around, too. Yeah, I've heard of them.
In the heyday of them, mm-hmm. I started out as an assistant to Lee. Then before I know it, they gave me some animation to do. Over the years, I became an assistant director, and by that time, I had moved on to different studios. So I was very much a freelance animator, and because I worked at home so I could raise my daughter, I had to find projects that I could come home, do, and take back. So animation was very good. And I learned how to do layouts. I knew how to do character design. I had to learn all of these things because if that job didn't work out, okay. And in those days, it was word of mouth.
Yeah.
I didn't even have a portfolio. I could go into a studio and say, hey, I would always know somebody. And I said, hey, what's going on? Oh, yeah, we have, okay, I can do that. You need any help? Okay, I'll see you next week.
When did Klatsky start?
In the 90s. I think in the 90s.
Was your child all grown up by that point?
Like, yeah. She was, I was a freelance animator for about 20 years. And the thing is, you can't raise up in the studio. You can't get better work if you work at home.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I finally started working in studio at Duck Soup. And that's where I really had a ball. Because that's a small studio. And this is ideal for any young person who is starting now. Find a small production studio that makes little commercials or they have a little project. And start at the bottom and do. I can do that. You know, be helpful. You know, I'll clean that up. I'll do that. I don't, you know, Now everything is on computers, so obviously you have to have your computer skills, you know. Everybody should know Photoshop, right? They should know probably Premiere, probably other things. I don't know yet.
I don't know that crap.
I know.
They gave me Storyboard Pro to do storyboards, but I don't like it. It's a program that makes it easier for other departments to do their job at the expense of yours.
And ours is the most important, to draw. Okay, so I've been a life drawer all the time. Now, I didn't just stop in animation. She can testify to this. I draw 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was going to bring a sketchbook and I forgot. But I have been drawing my life, all my life. I love to draw. I'm just favorite things, and I'm just a life drawer.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that skill, and they don't teach it enough in the art schools and the animation schools, and you have to stress this.
Yeah.
Because every pre-production and every really good studio wants you to know how to draw, don't they?
Yeah. I've said for forever that animation is the last refuge of classical drawing. And it's the skill that leads to all the others. Because what I learned from 2.5 years of pretty intensive life drawing was how to turn form in space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you do.
It's so much easier when you know the proportions. It's like second nature.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing is you're literally drawing your body. It's so cool. And I love to dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a very physical person. And I love, you know, what I love about commercials, it's 30 seconds. And in the beginning, when I was working on commercials, okay, you would have maybe 6 scenes. Oh, wow, that was a big deal. By the time I finished, there were like 30 scenes, 25. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Well, it's a very cutty commercial.
Well, that's the way commercials are now.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
It's like cut, cut, cut. Yeah. And that's how fast everything kind of... Because, you know, they got new technology. They say, oh, well, we can do this, we can do this, we can do that. But I'm very old school when it comes to the quality and drawing animation and actually animating, you know. One of the things that I really am proud of and that I was really thrilled, I helped start an animation school up in Vancouver. It's called Van Arts. It's Van Arts or some media. Now it's a media, School of Media Arts. Mm-hmm. And my mentor, Lee Mishkin, later on in his career after I've been working and stuff, got lung cancer. He had to retire. He had one lung, and he was just about ready to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just by coincidence, somebody I knew, through meditation, let's just say through that, a gal from Vancouver was looking. She wanted to start an old school. She got my name. And I was like her, what you call her, consultant.
Mm-hmm.
She took me up to Vancouver. I saw what she was trying to do. And through that, I got Lee Mishkin to become the first dean of animation in that school. And last December, I just went to the 20th anniversary. For 20 years, I've been going up to Vancouver.
That's amazing.
And it's a fabulous school. You can look it up on the front. It's a beautiful school.
So you freelanced for 20 years, and then how did you get involved with Klasky Chupa?
Okay, so I started working at Duck Soup.
Yeah.
And so through that association, Klasky Chupa started out, you know, with The Simpsons. They started The Simpsons.
I think I forgot all about that.
Yes, they started The Simpsons in their garage, and I knew somebody. That said, and I was always looking, I didn't just have one job. I always had two or three.
Mm-hmm.
I had to work on the weekend at night just to maintain, you know, always you had to have your finger in the pie. So I was either, and in those days, animation wasn't so easy to come by because that's when things started going overseas. First they ink and paint, then assisted animation, and then animation. And so what we animators could do, we did sheet timing, which they still do, I guess.
Yes, it's interesting. My boss was a timer. So we have a well-supported timing department, but it's still not the same.
No, I mean, we were literally teaching the animators overseas how to do everything. We, Klasky Tsupo started out with The Simpsons, and that's what got them on their feet. They did the Tracy Ullman show, which were the first little vignettes of The Simpsons. Who's the guy that does it?
Matt Groening.
Yeah, him and...
They were just like little interstitial characters. And I seem to remember that at the time... he came up with these characters because he was so protective of life in hell, and he didn't want to lose ownership of that. So, you know, that's interesting.
The rest is history.
Yes.
Right? So they got the series, first of all. They started, and when I, you know, I had a very dear friend, the guy that I worked with on Fairies. He was like a director for, he was working there, and that's how he said, well, I can get you some sheet timing on The Simpsons. And just when I started, and it was like, you know, I had to take tests and stuff. You couldn't just walk in. They always had tests in those days, right? Sheet timing tests and layout tests and all these different kinds of tests.
Did they indeed? Because the union is making a bit of a stink about it right now.
Really?
Yes, because a lot of people are getting these kind of arguably excessive storyboard tests. You know, you would get like a page. And it's my belief that if they ask you to do a storyboard test, that it tells me that they don't understand how to look at a portfolio. So it sort of tells me, it gives me their ceiling of competence. And it's a long time since I've had to do a test. And generally, if they ask me to do a test, I say, you know, thanks, but no thanks.
Yes, because you have that level of experience.
If you can't tell from my storyboards,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And I'm pretty good at it, you know,
exactly.
If you can't tell what you're looking at, I don't think I want to work for you.
So Klasky Tsupo was sort of faced like what Disney was faced with. Oh, just one more thing. So that school that where I was talking about, Van Art. Okay, some of the very first students. It had its rough parts, but some of the very first students came down to Hollywood, and they got some good training, and some of them actually worked for me. I hired them at Klasky Tsupo to be my assistant. They went into the Disney training, and they went into Pixar, and now they're famous Pixar animators and directors, and they go around the world lecturing.
That's annoying.
I know. They were boys, of course.
Yeah.
So anyhow...
Well, hold on. I mean, do you think that makes a difference in why, like, you're not traveling more and doing talks?
I would think so. You know, that's why we started Women in Animation. Hello? That's where we had how many years? 15, 20 years of different lectures and seminars.
Yeah.
And pulling all the women that we could find. Sometimes we had difficulty finding women for our panels.
Yeah, well, that was the whole purpose of the organization was... for giving women a chance to network, because we were sort of scattered.
Few and far between.
Yeah, sort of scattered like raisins in a pan of muffins.
Yeah.
You know, the situation has changed a lot, but
Very much so. Now there's so many women in it, it's ridiculous. There's more women at the school now than men. It used to be one or two girls and the rest guys.
Yeah.
Now there's more women.
Yeah, but I think, like, only 20%, like, in the industry and, like higher-up creative roles, like, directing and above. Even storyboard artists, there's not a lot of women storyboard artists.
No, or character design. Well, maybe more so on character design now.
There's actually...
I don't know.
There's
about
only
that.
One woman character designer that I know. Oh,
well, that's Ritzko.
Huh?
Yeah, Ritzko on Elena.
Yeah.
And she's very... She's very experienced. I've been working with her for years.
Klasky Trooper was a very great studio to work for because, first of all, it was run by foreigners and they refused any kind of Disney, any kind of American-style animation. Ugh, they hated it. So they had all these Europeans, Russians, Czechoslovakians, Chinese, you know, but really good artists, all filmmakers from Europe, you know, with these weird styles. You saw, you know, the Rugrats, come on.
Duckman.
Duckman. I worked on Duckman, the Rugrats, all the Nickelodeon, while Thornberries, they had such a creative crew. As Told by Ginger, do you remember that one?
Yes, I do.
I love that one.
Me too.
And Rocket Power.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened with Klasky Trooper? I created a little niche for myself. Inside the studio, they had a department that just did short form. They did interstitials, titles, and commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And since I had a background in commercials, working freelance, and I had a portfolio of that reel, I got hired first as an assistant animator, then as an assistant animator with the promise that I would be a director.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's the promise. Well, you know, time goes on, and people come and go, and all these guys are directing, and they're good. Finally, they were going to hire somebody that I had trained. He was a young black man, very talented. But they were going to make him a director. I walked in there, I said, you are, listen, I deserve this. If you're going to get another director, it's going to be me, or I'm gone. Because I was the one that did all the damn work.
Mm-hmm.
There's always somebody, they take all the glory, and then the assistant director does all the work.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it. Yeah, so I said, no. And they made me a director. Okay.
Did it take, pepping yourself up to go in there and talk to them? Or were you just so pissed?
Yes, kidding. It was like, I was pissed off. I was never very good about putting myself forward. But, you know, I always had my ears open. And whenever an opportunity came, I sort of like, oh, I can do that. I'll help. Do you need any help? You just had to kind of be that way in order to get work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And directing in TV is different from directing in feature. Because there's this thing about management, and it was especially true in DTS, which was the department in Disney Animation that was about making sequels.
Mm.
There were mad people in charge, and it became kind of like baseball. The director was in some ways the most vulnerable person on the crew because you couldn't just fire the crew, so you would fire the director. You know, it was like in baseball, if your team doesn't have a good season, you fire the manager. You don't fire the team.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some bad experiences with that particular way of solving problems. So it seemed to me that I'd subsequently gotten directing gigs in other studios, and it's just easier to be a director in television because it moves too quickly to just replace people, except for gross incompetence.
Well, you know, I have to say that as a studio setup, Klasky Csupo had it down. They had a great, they really put out some good animation, very dense, very densely drawn. The people that worked the hardest were the storyboard artists, and then the tea timers.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was so complicated, but the storyboard artists, they were so good. They were all animators. They were all new timing because they timed everything. And they even timed, you had to time the sheets, although it was slugged by the director. I mean, it was a whole different, everybody knew exactly how what they had to do to hand it to the next one. Mm-hmm. And the schedules were maddening. And I tell you, the storyboards were 3 inches thick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were like giant books.
And do you want to explain slugging?
Well, slugging was, that's something that the director usually did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as a director, like, say I'm doing a commercial, and you have a storyboard, you sit with your timer, your stopwatch or whatever, and you literally have to time each scene out, okay, intro, 3 seconds, okay, 1.5 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and then you have your X sheets, and you mark your sheets, and every frame, and so the slugging, so the animation that you do as an animator, you get through your X sheets, you've got to fit it into that timing.
Mm-hmm.
And make it work. It's really fun, actually.
I slugged a couple of episodes of Dilbert, and they said, it's too tight.
Mm.
The executive producers like to play around.
Well, it is. It's a style. Slugging has to reflect the style of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and timing. Well, see, I did a lot. I liked commercials. As an animator, I liked my little department at Klasky Csupo because we got projects at 5-week deadlines, 6-week. If we got an 8-week deadline, it was a miracle. But all that goes into a 30-second commercial is intense. And you have a small crew, and as a director, I get to do all the fun creative stuff. I mean, it has to be done in 3 days, you know. I have to design the characters, I have to do the storyboard, I have to pitch it, I have to meet with the client, you know, I have to create the sheets, I have to do the layouts. If I'm lucky, I'll have help with some of that.
That's a boot camp.
I know.
Wow.
You really have to have a metabolism for it, because it is very fast-paced.
That's what you learn in commercials. You would get damn good at making small films.
Mm-hmm.
Timing is impeccable. Your time, well, that's what animation teaches you, is timing. That's what I love about animation. I mean, what you can learn by just 3 frames or 4 frames, the difference it makes in the timing of a movement, either you see it or you don't, or you slow into it and you hold it and then you go out again. It's so much better than Flash.
Yeah.
See, Flash is like, you know?
Yeah.
They might
because they're not using it right, because you can do slow ins and slow outs.
It's getting better.
But the principles of animation still are the principles of animation, and I love them.
John Pomeroy was in the studio last week, and I was talking to an editor named Peter Kaufman. Jamie Mitchell were looking at some animation that had just come in from Korea. And Peter said it was like a masterclass in animation timing, because John could look at a scene and say, well, you know, this, you need to open this up like 3 frames, or, you know, tighten this up by a couple of frames. You know, he just still has this wonderful eye for action. He's been storyboarding on Sophia, and they're just wonderful boards. They're impeccably drawn. they're clear, you know, it's just, you know, a privilege to have him on the show.
A good storyboard, you could film it, which they do,
yeah.
And you hardly even need any in-betweens. You don't even almost have to animate it. It's a story.
Yeah.
It just flows. And that was always a thrill for me to have, to see the animatic and to see how it all times out. So the actual, by the time you do your animatic, it's done.
Yeah.
The hard work you give to the animators and the assistants and the cleanup people. But your job as a director, you know, and then you, of course, I have to make sure. I'm a very anal director. I look at everybody's drawings. I personally check things. Everything has to be a model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do all the color keys. I sit with the editor. I love that part.
Yeah.
On Stuart Little, which was actually a CGI show, the executives insisted that everything be drawn perfectly on model.
Mm. They
because I think it was their lack of imagination. You know, they couldn't tell the cat apart from the mouse unless it looked just like the model sheet, which, of course, was a terrible pain because it slows the process down when you have to make sure that everything looks just so.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best storyboard artists had his own style of
uh-huh.
drawing the characters, which wasn't necessarily
on
model.
But it was full of life.
Yeah, I love looking at his stuff.
Yeah. Well, that was the same thing with the Rugrat storyboards. They're really good people.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of them. I could draw the Rugrats rough, you know, and the action. And it was very lucky because I got to do a few storyboards on the features. So I got a little feature animation storyboarding under my belt. And I did storyboarding for TV, which I didn't like. I preferred storyboarding for commercials and doing small short form. Because, boy, I did all the interstitials for Nickelodeon, all the shows I animated and designed, all the interstitials. It was so much. An interstitial could be 5 seconds, 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, have more control when the process is too fast for them to fire you.
Did you do the interstitial of Aura Monsters, where the guy with the who holds his hands? I forgot his name, but he bounces his eyeball. That's the one that comes to mind right now.
I can show you some stuff by real when we're done.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
I got it with me. So anyhow, I did work at Klasky Supo for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the last staff directors to be laid off.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Nickelodeon and Viacom, their contract finished, they had like a 10-year contract. Klasky Supo put Nickelodeon on the map.
Yeah.
Come on. They made the Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
And anyhow, Cartoon Network came around, and that was fun because they really revitalized with the short form, and that was the start. You know, Cartoon Network was a whole other really cool studio that started really interesting. But, you know, that's like an offshoot of Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah,
and that case started from whatever.
Yeah, you know, there's like it's like a gene pool.
I know.
You know. I come out of one particular tradition, and you come out of another.
And the first Cartoon Network people, and some of the first as the new generation of directors came out of CalArts.
Mm-hmm.
They had some very good early CalArts animators. Oh, really good. But they didn't know anything about traditionally production work. I remember I was working for a small studio and I had to train a CalArts. He was this big guy. He was an incredible animator. He made this film. I gave him an assignment. He didn't know what X sheets were.
That seems to be a constant. I had... I had a third year student come up to me when I was teaching character design there. And he said, how do you time a run? I had to wait for a week to explain this to him because I had to, you know, I had some special gear that I use for this kind of thing. I have a stopwatch with a 10-second sweep, and I had a metronome, and I had to show him how all this related to those little spaces on the X sheet. And it was kind of appalling to me that a guy who'd been there for 3 years didn't know anything about this. I had him run down the corridor, and I timed it, and I showed him how to, you know, divide that time into how many steps he took and how to get that onto the X sheet. And it's like basic thing. When I came to Disney, that was kind of my first lesson, was how to fill out an X sheet.
And Hanna-Barbera lived by their X sheets, and they had walk cycles, frame, 12 frame, 24 frame walk cycles, you know. That was just basic 101 animation. Everybody knew how to do that.
Except at Cal Arts, where you're supposed to be a damned auteur.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it was ridiculous, really. And we used to laugh at these Cal Arts students. They were all prima donnas. And some of them got to be directors. One of them directed on...
a lot of them. That class of 77 was... you know, all these brilliant guys came out of that particular class. Ron Clements, John Musker, I think Lasseter came out of there. Brad Bird came out of that.
Yeah.
And they all came in, a little bit after I started at Disney. And you could sort of see the hierarchy thing happening, because all the Cal Arts guys got to assist Frank and Ollie. And because I had gone to the wrong school, I didn't get to assist Frank and Ollie. And this was kind of the little irritant that eventually led us to Don and John and Gary, who were interested in developing a new generation of animators.
Yeah.
And that was, the Cal Arts guys referred rather contemptuously to the Bluth clique. But, you know, there were some pretty talented people in it.
They were all talented in those days. Come on, there was very few. Yeah, even at Hanna-Barbera, which was considered not the highest level of animation, but still in the beginnings in the 60s and, you know, before they just kind of sold out, there was delightful animation, really. I mean, come on, they're still favorites of people, you know. Silly, silly stuff.
Yeah. They had great characters, you know.
Well, you know, nowadays I don't even relate to some of these characters. There's no story involved. The stylizing is 10 different looks all in one. There's not, or so busy because they have all this technology, but they have no sense of style. I think Sophia is one of the few that really has a sense of style. And I mean, I don't know animation so much now because I don't watch everything that's on anymore.
Well, Sophia was a little, kind of the little idea that grew. It wasn't supposed to be quite as classical Disney as it ended up being. And, you know, that was almost by accident.
But you still see classical Disney as still a standard.
Yes.
And Warner Brothers and Looney Tunes are still the standard, you know. And classic... what would you say? Okay, I was seeing some old Hanna-Barbera stuff. I went to a reunion last week, and they were, you know, that the special effects and everything, they look just like the Powderpuff Girls, all the stuff that was later done by Cartoon Network, you can see where they got. I just got it. I said, oh my God, they were Hanna-Barbera fans.
Yeah.
Because they went back to that really silly stylized, but they were very good, you know. Some of that.
And Flash gives you that same kind of
Dexter's
effect.
Laboratory, you know. Mm-hmm. All those early Cartoon Network things. It was very stylized and very limited animation, and it was always fun.
Yeah, the directors on The 7D, which is the show I work on, they're always referring back to Warner Brothers Animation and stuff like that.
Well, they have to, because that's the good stuff.
Yes.
So I was very happy that I learned from excellent animators Disney-style animation from the very beginning. When I worked on that Fairies, I was the first woman working on that as an only animator. And they gave me the Fairy Princess to animate, and I did such a good job that the Disney animator, Freddie Helmick, he said to my friend at Lee Michigan, he says, I think we have a new girl animator. And that was actually a compliment, not me being the girl. It meant an animator in Disney, they used to call them girl animators because they could draw girls really well.
Yeah. Oh, so it wasn't that you were a girl, just that you drew girls well.
So that was a compliment.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, there were...
Different animators were good at different things, right?
Yeah, I remember Milt Kahl being quoted that... with some dissatisfaction that on Sleeping Beauty, he was made to draw the prince. Because the prince is kind of a stick.
Yeah.
Mark Davis got a lot of female characters.
Oh, he was the master of them.
Yeah.
I used to look at Mark Davis as some
monster. Oh, yeah. Every time I think I'm a hot draftsman, I just look at his stuff, and that puts me in my place.
So anyhow, that's it. And when, also interesting thing about Classical Tsupo, they were one of the first studios that had women directors directing TV.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of my women in animation seminars that we put on, what did we call it?
Was it a salon?
Salon or something like that. I had it at Classical Tsupo, and we had five women directors, plus myself, in one studio. It was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
Unheard of.
Yeah.
That was a first.
I think one of the reasons that Sophia has been as good a show as it has been is that we have a lot of female writers. We had like four.
Mm-hmm. We had female writers at Classic too.
Yeah.
As told by Ginger. And there was another one. And we had female directors on the series, on the feature. One of the first female directors on the feature. So, Classical Tsupo was a really good place for me as an artist to be exposed to different kind of artists.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the heart of Hollywood, but I'm not doing Hollywood animation. I'm doing, you know, foreign animation, which was really fun.
I think probably that might be one of the reasons they were more open to hiring women.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, some of those barriers didn't exist in Europe.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they really looked at portfolios in those days. They had portfolio days, and as a director, I would get it. They would call me up and say, look at these portfolios. And portfolios were really good. I mean, you have to have a good portfolio. Mm-hmm. Life drawing, all kinds of. You could really tell by a person's portfolio if they were a good artist.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do nowadays.
I've heard when I was in school, like, portfolio matters, but who you know matters more, which I think should be reversed.
I do too.
Obviously.
You're only as good as your last drawing. That's how we used to call it. Say, you know, you know, you really have to know what you're doing. But you see, it has changed. And I have to admit that I was one of the people that developed the first computer ink and paint system.
Oh, wow.
And we it was called U.S. Animation.
Mm-hmm.
It was developed in the United States. Remember? Did you guys
I remember something? Working in it in 1984. And it was a pain in the ass because you had to remember to
fill in
all the color shapes or else it would run.
I know. I had to develop a whole technique of, let's just say, for years, when you only had six levels to work with, we had to develop ways. We had to shoot it, combine it, and then we had to have a separate run for cast shadows, a separate one for highlights, for tones. In fact, there was a whole area of expertise. They were called special effects artists.
Yeah.
That just did tones, highlights, cast shadows, and that's what they animated. And see, it all had to be done, so it wasn't all jiggly, because these were all matted over the original artwork. Mm-hmm. It was a very complex thing. But once we got on a computer, we could scan all that in and just combine
that
it.
That was wonderful. I remember on Dragon's Lair, trying to come up with an effect of sequins on the princess's costume. And what, you know, we used Exeter paper, this dense black paper.
We've done that and you did holes in it, right?
And yes, but what we also did was take little bits of gel and tape it under the Exeter paper to make it sparkle in colors. So it was a really pretty effect.
Mm. We had to just jump through hoops to do some things. We had to just figure out how to do stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's what you did.
Yeah. And the best thing that ever happened in animation was the instant replay of a pencil test where you could actually...
It took years off
the
schedule.
And they had reel-to-reel... things and your camera with a camera stand and you would do all these knobs and you would shoot.
They were like security cameras.
Oh man, that was like heaven on earth.
Yes.
It changed everything and your animation got so much better so quickly. Yeah,
because it compressed a process that could take, at Disney it took a day to turn around a pencil test.
Mm-hmm.
And Disney was probably about as fast as it got because, you know, mm-hmm. they had a stock method. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was like in other studios, but you would be waiting at least a day to see your scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then that first generation of Lion Lamb machines.
I had one.
Yes. It compressed it to however long it took for you to shoot your scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an immense time sink.
It was so exciting, and because then you can do your rough animation, you can shoot it, and it's just timing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then you already know what I can do this, and then you see what, and then you do the next level. You clean those drawings up, and you maybe add a few in betweens. Okay, that's going to work. Then you shoot it, and then you can. You've gotten time to have your actions ready, then you can give it to your assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And as an animator, I would even do a nice, clean blue line. So maybe not every drawing, but boy, it was on model, so I knew that there was on model.
Mm-hmm.
So when I gave it to my assistant, they knew exactly where to go with it. And they would do the final line and do the in-betweens.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Bluth taught me how to make that line work on curve. That was his secret. He animated in curves. He never did a straight line.
Yeah. Well, that's animation. I think curves are
Because that was I think I already told this story when I first started animating on Banjo. After I'd gotten the promotion to animator at Disney, I ended it. Instead of getting scenes, he put me to in-betweening his. And that was totally a master class. Because he was saying, figure out what I'm doing.
That's how I learned to animate, yep. You see? Pretty soon my Lee Michigan was giving me so much assisted work. He would do a drawing, a little rough couple here, 10 in-betweens, another drawing, you know, a little rough. And then I'm sitting there doing all the work, and I said to him, Lee, I'm going to become an animator now. I'm sick of cleaning up after you. I'm doing all the work already. I'm an animator now. Uh-huh. And he said, okay.
Did he give you charts?
He started giving me animation to do. And that's when fairies came around. And then I just said, I'm an animator now, and I couldn't get jobs at Disney, but I got jobs at, pick up stuff here and there in different studios. And mm-hmm. and I learned sheet tiny, But
it's interesting that every time that you made one of those career moves, you had to push them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because you just didn't have, I think there was one or two other female animators that I even met in that time.
Yeah.
There were a lot of assistant animators that were mostly females, and there were still jobs around, that were still in competition in a lot of studios.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Playhouse was a great one. They gave me my own commercials to do. They gave me stuff I could do from beginning to end. So that's how I started, being a director. I started doing the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Under the supervisor of Playhouse Pictures.
But at Disney, I think I was the isotope that caused the whole thing to reach critical mass. Because there were four women doing animation, and they could, we passed the requirement for the promotion.
Could they be promoted?
They couldn't keep us out.
They couldn't keep you out.
Wait, I don't think I follow.
You had to get 100 feet of animation into a show before they would promote you to animator. And on the small one, which was Bluth's project, four of us got over that barrier. And, mm-hmm. Bluth was very encouraging. He was giving us scenes. So we all managed to get that 100 feet.
That's a big deal.
It was. Yeah.
Now, in limited animation, when you were given an assignment, 100 feet a week was a good deal because you got paid by the foot.
Yeah.
That's how you used to get paid. Like, the animator would get $100 a foot, and the assistant maybe get $35 or $40,
Whoa, that's a big difference.
So that's a big difference,
Yeah, it's kind of a drag because they're doing a lot of work. And, mm-hmm. you write a few charts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's the way I work with my assistants.
But you see, Disney, I think it was harder for you to become an animator at Disney than it was for me, because I just said I was an animator one day, and I knew how to do it, And then I just had to prove myself by fulfilling the assignment.
Mm-hmm.
She had to be approved by the big boys.
Well, also, because it was a specific requirement.
Yeah.
Once you met that requirement, if you really did not promote us, then we would have had a legal case.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Because I believe Title IX was in effect then.
I wanted to ask you about, the time when you had your baby and started working from home. Did that affect you at work?
Absolutely.
You said that they were happy about it mostly, though.
Well, they, because of the job that I was doing, assistant animation. So that was something they could easily hand out. Again, you get so many scenes, so much footage. You maybe have 10 scenes, 20 scenes. You come home with this bundle and you have to do, you just do your work.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't that hard to do because a lot of it was cleaning up, just arms moving or heads moving or bodies and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't that bad. And then even when you started animating, when I started doing animation, like on Scooby-Doo, I worked on the Smurfs.
Mm-hmm.
We animated the summer fads and all those. Oh my God, that was fun. So anyhow, I brought it home and did it. Of course, what happens when you work at home, you're limited to how you can promote yourself in the studio. You cannot become an assistant director. You cannot become any a certain level where you have to be in the studio to work directly with the director and so forth and so on. So mm-hmm. some jobs are easier to work at home. Even animation can work, you can do at home. But not directing or assistant directing or producing or whatever, you know.
So you yes, really had to...
storyboarding should be better done in studio, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's interesting to note that of the, that group of four women who got promoted at the same time I did, only one of them had children.
Oh.
And she ended up going back into cleanup because her child had kidney problems.
Oh.
And it... animation just took too much of her headspace.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, you know, I will do cleanup. She eventually became the head of the department,
yeah.
But it was, you know, just a thing that she felt she had to do in order to keep her kid going.
It was very difficult to work at home, too, to tell you the truth and raise a kid. I had to find time.
Yeah.
And I had to, you know, run back and forth Mondays, maybe 2-3 times a week. I had to go to the studios, pick things up, deliver them. In those days, limited animation, you could pretty much deliver your work on Monday and pick it up on Monday and deliver it on Friday, maybe get some more work, whatever. They had it down to a system. But also... it made my life, I was just animating or working all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, like I said before, I had to make myself available and learn and, network.
Mm-hmm.
See, my network, that meant I had to go to lunch, you know, with people. I had to maintain my friendships with all the different animals.
You have to stay in people's faces.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was part of it.
Yeah. How do you suggest staying in people's faces, but respectfully? Like, do you have any advice for that?
They have a new women in animation now that is very much about networking, right?
Yeah.
So I would always go, I don't know what they do now. If you come from a school, do you have help through the school? Do they help place you? Do they give you hints? You have to go to...
I would imagine that if the teachers have any kind of background, they
mm-hmm.
might, you know, they might cough up a contact number.
Well, that's part of an animation school responsibility, to have people
mm-hmm.
come in. I remember I used to go to Otis and critique the students there.
Mm-hmm.
They always used to call me in to critique, especially film students. And they had a big deal. You know, of course, Otis is a little different,
yeah,
but
just
they
did
had
one
professors.
Mm-hmm.
In Van Arts, they always had all the professors' studios come in and check out the people's kids' portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, I don't know. You have to kind of research the studio and see what kind of art that you want, that you think you might be good at.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on your level of skill. And then you have to do all the hard work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how people get in anymore because there's so many, it's so competitive.
Yeah.
In a way, I think that the schools do a bit of a disservice.
Oh, absolutely. I can testify to that.
Because
they just want your money.
Well, yeah, class, and animation seems like an easy major. Little do they know.
Yeah.
And, you know, there just aren't that many jobs at any given time.
Yeah. And there's, because of that, like, there's such a high turnaround as well, just because, you know, it's like, you know, a few months to a few years work. Like, at my school, because I graduated in 2010, like, they would have guest speakers come in and, like, networking opportunities, but there really wasn't a placement service. Yeah. And they didn't really help unless you, like, really got on, you know, someone's good side during the, you know, class and everything.
Yeah.
It was more networking with each other. 5 years later, I now, like, well, 6 years later, I guess, I now realize that it was more connecting with other people at school because they get jobs somehow and then they can be your contact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing. And, you know, they used to have really strong recruitment programs. I remember Klasky, they had recruiters that went out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, Disney always had recruiters.
It's very cyclical. I seem to remember in the mid-90s, there was that animation boom.
That's
and
right, because
half the class I was teaching at CalArts got poached.
Yeah.
So I handed out a lot of incompletes that year.
Whoa.
So again, it is, depending on. And you know, like even in Vancouver, now Vancouver is really jumping. They get the kids that graduate get a job, but they work on computers. They don't draw. They draw on computers. When they even work on, they have something called Harmony, which is a new animation computer program.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you
get it puts a line around things.
Oh,
huh.
Terrible.
Okay. Yeah, we used
it's
to do
fuzzy line, right? That you're talking about.
Yeah,
around
kind
the
of. The first season of Sophia, we used it, but subsequently we stopped.
It's like Flash, but it's, I don't even know. When I saw him, the teacher that's in Dean Dow. They teach it, and they still teach basic animation, but to me, all the fun has gone out of it. If you can't draw it and change it quickly, and I mean, when I was teaching the students, and they were flipping papers, and I could sit down and correct a drawing, and then, oh my God, one little drawing it would make, the way their faces would light up. Oh, that's all I needed, you know, and that's how I learned.
Yeah.
He would just do a little thing. Oh, yeah, I get it now. You know, it was all about just the placement of that line.
Yeah.
You know, just a little bit of time.
In character design, you can still do that.
Yeah.
You know, you still have the ability to do a lot with a little.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's one of the fun things, this character designer wannabe. Yeah, he's been given an opportunity to do some characters, but you know, I still have to redraw them.
I know.
But that's fine, because that's the way you learn, by having your work
critique.
Redone by other people with more experience.
Exactly.
And you know, I would just say to him the same thing I say to everyone else, which is, you know, get as much life drawing as you possibly can.
Thank you for
that. And look at a lot of shit.
That brings me back to that. That's
mm-hmm.
exactly. You want to keep a sketchbook. Don't just draw on an iPad with your finger, for God's sakes. Draw with pen, ink, pencil. Keep your chops up. You know, and do it for yourself.
Well, I disagree about the iPad because it's like whatever you use it.
Yeah.
You know, an iPad is as good as a piece of paper. It's just a matter of what you work with.
Yeah, you know, as long as you keep drawing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Personally, I prefer paper, but that's me, you
it
know?
Has its advantages.
Mm-hmm.
It won't disappear if you drop it.
But you see, I'm old school, and I'm, well, you know, I'm just old school.
Yeah. I don't have an iPad, but, like, I think it's a really cool tool. But with paper, it's just so intuitive, you know?
Yeah. It's, well, that little surface-to-surface interface is kind of nicer than a sheet of glass.
To me, and my hand-mind coordination that comes from that repetitive movement, from the feel of the texture, from the weight of the pen, you know, and, you know, just I like flipping.
That is a nice thing, because, you know, it's very direct, and that is the thing that I miss with the computer process. It's sort of like before you learn to flip and you're trying to eyeball something through several sheets of paper. It's not as accurate. You know, that is
absolutely.
That is the interesting thing about flipping drawings, because you can, you know, you train the eye to see that little discontinuity. It's especially important in cleanup. It's less important in rough animation, but you know, you can see if
the light is like this always.
Yeah, you get used to that little linear jerk,
yeah.
And then you can
clean it up
and you know, smooth out the line, yeah. And because if it bothers you when it's tiny, it's really going to bother you when it's big.
Mm. Yeah, animation is one of the greatest art forms for someone who loves to draw. I mean, come on. You're drawing every single frame of the picture. I really feel sorry for kids, though.
It is totally absurd when you think about it. Oh, let's make a movie one frame at a time by hand.
Yeah, I know. Yes, but, you see, that's how stories have always been told, even in the old Chinese scrolls.
Oh, yeah.
They look like storyboards.
Mm-hmm.
When you look out there, everybody's, the Egyptians are telling stories with their pictures.
One thing I really love about your story, and also yours, is that you guys are driven by animation as a craft in filmmaking. And today, a lot of people I talk to are like, I really want to work for Disney, and like they focus more on the studio, which is good to know what studios match like your kind of values, I guess, mm-hmm. if it's that or like the style of the product coming out. But
well, it was explicitly my destiny to work for Disney,
yeah. And I didn't know what I was doing. I just got a job there. I just could draw, and I happened to come out to California with my boyfriend and got a job at the ink and paint department. And Hanna-Barbera in the busy season. You know, they would hire anybody, you know.
Yeah.
Just get the damn thing done by September so we can get it on TV, because that's when all the new shows started.
Yeah.
And that was destiny. There was no question about it that I should get the idea in my head in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and happened to be going to California with a boyfriend. And he was going to be a drummer, blah, blah, blah. And I got my first job at Hanna-Barbera.
Mm-hmm.
The very first week I came here.
Oh,
you dated a drummer?
One of the many musicians I dated. Yeah.
Musicians were kind of your type?
Yeah.
So are you retired now?
What a terrible word.
I know, I'm sorry.
I was aged out of my studio. I was like the last remaining female, older person in that studio that was before they went under, but I was aged out. Literally before that, they were hiring younger people and cheaper. I was making more money, so they wanted to get rid of me because they were, at that time they were kind of going under.
So your skill set was not an issue here, because you can hire a young guy, but you know you're going to end up doing your movie twice.
Yeah, well, they were kind of drowning at that point.
Yeah.
And Klasky was the woman, and she was sort of running things, and Tupo, Gabor Chupo, he was into directing live action. After he, you know, they kind of lost their thing and they didn't get, they tried to do several series and it wasn't going anywhere. He got distracted. He got disinterested. He got a job directing live action and the studio just sort of dissolved.
Yeah. And were, did you say aged out? That you were aged
I was out? Definitely aged out, yeah.
Oh. Like, what did you, because you did more commercials after that, though, right?
I did.
Like, did, I feel like that still happens, you know, because people just end up making more money, and that's a
especially
lot of different workforces.
Okay, because I was an older white woman. Come on. Uh-huh. All they, in the, you know, in the commercial area, they look on the internet, so this guy looks like he's got style. So every time you're pitching something to a client, you have to have, like, 10 different directors and they always say, oh, I want that guy. Mm-hmm. And so I had to always be picked. And luckily, there was enough of my style of art, you know, that I got that was always busy until the final. I did a whole series of commercials for the Bratz, the doll.
Mm-hmm.
It was an, I hated the project. We were so sick of each other. And so when that was over, they didn't try getting me any more work.
Mm-hmm.
They tried a little bit, but they got one of these young, kind of, you know, non-experienced people that had an unusual look.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
To tell you the truth, I had other things I had to do, and I had other fish to fry. I had a disease, I got sick, I got this, and
mm-hmm.
So I was sort of like put on hiatus, essentially laid off. And then I never really worked in a commercial studio. This was in 2007. So I have had maybe 4 or 5 art shows since then. I've done some storybooks. I never published them, but I've done, you know, all kinds of stuff on my own. And moved to Fairfield, Iowa last year. I moved away from Hollywood altogether. And so I just do art for myself now.
Nice.
But I have some animated projects that I'd love to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just need now new equipment because all my equipment is old.
Yeah. Yeah, this is super cheap microphone. You use what you have, you know?
Exactly. God bless you for doing this.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Well, we're used to this. We like this. This is what we used to do in women in animation.
Yeah.
We would have a panel of 4 or 5 people. We talk about different things.
I'm curious, like, how it feels to no longer live in Hollywood. Like, are you more relieved? I don't know. Out here, I feel like I'm always on guard for some reason.
I can't tell you the difference.
A lot of crazy people.
Yeah.
First of all, I chose one of the finest little towns in America.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an OTM meditator. Half the town meditates. There's a university there. It's called the Maharishi University that teaches TM. And you can computer science. This is a full university. And David Lynch has a film program there.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
They have every month something called Art Walk, where they, all the places they put up art, or they have different themes, they have music, once a month, every month, the first Friday, the whole town turns out for something or other, you know?
Yeah.
They have artists there that are incredible. The Iowa has fabulous artists, who knew? But they're fine artists, and nobody makes a living. You know, it's like very tough.
Yeah.
But they have filmmakers there, and they're all excited that I'm there. So I'm hoping, I haven't been here, I just moved there last year. I already gave a lecture about authentic animation. I showed all my some artwork, I showed my reel, and they loved it. So I am going, looking forward to developing a lecture series that I can go to the schools
that's
and
a great
give,
idea.
You know.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that was, like, one of the few things I found online about you. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, there's not a lot of information out there.
No, there isn't. I should really fill in my history of that, because nobody really knows my history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's another thing I found, and one of the reasons I started the podcast was because, like, I never really realized it before, because, you know, you just kind of grow up and information's given to you, and then you don't really start dissecting it till, like, your 20s and you get some life experience. But, like, all the animators I looked up to were men, and it just, like, hit me a few years ago. I was like, wait a second, you know, there's more women than just Mary Blair or Retta Scott out there. And so I ended up doing this podcast. Isn't it weird that we have panels about women a little bit?
Well,
I'm glad, but, you know, it's weird that
we're still a category.
Yeah.
But women are very much prominent in the animation business. Oh, come on.
Yeah.
It's like, hello, they run things.
Well, it's interesting that there's more women on the producer track than the director track.
Well, that's always been the way.
It's always been the way, and it's because the producer track starts at the receptionist's desk. Because the receptionist is the one that has the Rolodex. And the thing about, you know, the producer is it's about the relationships. Mm-hmm. It's not so much about the craft part, because you can always hire people to do that.
Well, that's what their job is to hire people. So the more people you know, and you have to cast them as you have to know their character animation, because each character animator has a different... He'll do that character, or he can do that. He's slow, but he's good. Mm-hmm. He's fast. We can deal with him. We need somebody who can really draw. He's good enough for that. Mm-hmm. It's a very tough... It's not easy if you're good at what you do.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving a review on iTunes. It helps us reach and share these stories with a wider audience. In sharing these female voices, we strive not only to help pave a path for aspiring women professionals, but to build a community and safe space for female creatives to support and empower one another. Like life, working in these industries is not a destination, but a journey of hopping from project to project and developing your craft. So I think we could all use the support. Want to chat? We're on Twitter at Ink, the letter N, Paint Girls, on Facebook at Ink and Paint Girls Podcast, or email us at inkandpaintgirlspodcast@gmail.com. The Ink and Paint Girls Podcast is brought to you by me, creator and host Cassie Soliday, and produced by Val Patron in sunny Burbank, California. Music composed by TV's Kyle. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Girls Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.